Chapter 3, 0617 Hours. The questioning took 49 long minutes. Bald and Porter had been taken to a dreary glass-fronted office block on High Holborn, opposite a row of tatty souvenir shops and grubby boozers. They were shown into a bland interview room with a two-way mirror and found a guy in a shark-skin suit waiting for them inside. He introduced himself as Charles Capewell, QC, and explained that he was one of the firm's legal advisers, and that he had been brought in to advise Bald and Porter during the interrogation. If either of them was asked a question that might incriminate them, Capewell said, he would step in and cut the interview short. Bald and Porter both nodded. They had done this before. They knew the drill. After a while, a pair of investigators stepped into the room and introduced themselves, a guy called Westwood and a guy called Steer. They were both former police officers, and they both looked the part. Weary look in the eyes, beer bellies that threatened to burst out of their crumpled white shirts. They sat down opposite Bald and Porter and Capewell, and said they had a few questions. They were broadly sympathetic, Westwood explained. They still had friends on the force. They knew how these things worked. They listened patiently as Bald and Porter walked them through the shooting. First Bald, then Porter. Then they walked them through it again. The investigators took notes, asked a few questions, and didn't press too hard, as if they were going through the motions. Every so often Capewell intervened and told them in a firm but polite voice that his clients would not be answering a particular question. When they were finished, Westwood said Bald and Porter were free to leave. He said they would have to interview Kemper and the other officers after the debrief. Steer added that if they had any more questions, they would be in touch. He thanked Bald and Porter for their time, Capewell made his excuses, and left. 2 minutes after they left the building, Porter's pager buzzed. Both he and Bald carried MOD-issued Motorola pagers clipped to their belts. It allowed their handler to contact them at any time, day or night. The pagers received 2 test messages a day, one at 7 o'clock in the morning and another at 7 o'clock at night. As soon as they received the test messages, the guys had to check in on the secure line at Thames House. So when Porter's pager buzzed, he figured it was the first test message of the day coming through. Then he glanced at his G-Shock. 0620 hours. Too early for the test message, which meant that someone at the firm was reaching out to him. He unclipped the pager from his belt and squinted at the tiny luminous screen. Messages sent from the firm were in the form of a 3-digit code. The different numbers corresponded to different instructions that Bald and Porter had committed to memory when they had transferred from Hereford. The number 555, for example, told them to check in with Thames House as soon as possible, whereas 111 told the guys to drop everything and get over to the safe house immediately. A 111 was the most urgent type of message that the Blades could receive. Porter stopped and stared at the pager. The message on the screen read 111. 60 seconds later, they were hailing a black cab. The safe house was off Edgware Road, less than 3 miles away, but a 40-minute journey, even at 6:30 in the morning. The pavements were mostly empty except for a few joggers and shift workers, but the roads were clogged with early morning traffic. Delivery trucks, white vans, taxis, buses, cyclists. The speed of the traffic was somewhere between standstill and slow crawl. The taxi driver shuttled north on Southampton Row, past Russell Square tube station, and then hooked a left and crawled along the Euston Road. Everywhere Porter looked, the skyline was dominated by industrial cranes and the skeletal outlines of half-finished skyscrapers and high-rise apartment blocks. The city transforming.
It's come a long way since I grew up in Bethnal Green, Porter thought. Give it another 10 years, and I'll hardly recognize the place.
They headed east on the Euston Road for a mile and a half, past the steel and glass buildings around Great Portland Street, and the crowds of tourists around Baker Street, and the multi-million-pound houses lining Regent's Park. The driver inched through Marylebone, and then angled left after Westminster Magistrates Court, rolled down Old Marylebone Road for a couple of 100 metres, crossed the Edgware Road, past the shisha bars and Turkish coffee shops and greasy Lebanese restaurants.
headed down Sussex Gardens and took the first right onto Sale Place. After 50 metres, the driver eased off the gas and pulled over. Porter handed him a 20 and got a handful of pocket shrapnel in change. Then he climbed out of the cab with Bald, and the two of them waited until the taxi had pulled out and disappeared from view. They walked north on Sale for 40 metres, then hung a left onto Star Street. The safe house was set midway down a row of discreet whitewashed terraces. It looked like any other house on the street, with its small tiled porch and wrought iron fence overlooking the basement. The only difference was that the curtains had been pulled across all the windows. From the outside, the place looked neat, tidy, anonymous, the kind of place that wouldn't attract attention, which made it the perfect location for a safe house. Bald fished a set of keys out of his jeans pocket, unlocked the door, and stepped into the hallway. Bald stopped in his tracks and listened. "Alarm's been disabled," he said. Porter nodded. "We're not the first ones here, then." They headed down the hallway and made for the stairs. The place was modern but sparsely furnished, like an IKEA showroom 5 minutes after the clearance sale had ended. Porter followed Bald down the stairs into the basement. They paced down a short corridor and made for the heavy-duty door at the far end. A pair of flunkies in shiny suits stood either side of the door. One of the suits spoke into his microphone while the other pulled open the door. Then the flunkies stepped aside and Bald and Porter entered. The briefing room looked like a recording studio, minus the music equipment. The walls and ceilings were lined with egg-box-shaped foam that was specially designed to absorb any sound, which meant that conversations that took place inside the room would not transmit to anyone potentially listening in from the outside. There were no windows inside the basement, and the only light came from a couple of tall halogen lamps burning in separate corners of the room. An American security safe the size of a Smeg fridge stood against the far wall, the kind of thing a Texas gun fanatic might stash his assault rifles in. There was a plain metal desk in the middle of the room, with a Cisco phone on it, hooked up to a secure line, and four metal chairs. Porter knew the layout of the basement room like the back of his hand. He'd been in this place more times than he cared to remember over the last year. The firm had dozens of safe houses just like this one, scattered across the capital. He turned his attention to the two figures in the middle of the room. Clarence Hawkridge stood leaning against the edge of the desk, his arms folded across his front while he tapped a black leather brogue against the floor. A woman Porter didn't recognize sat at one of the chairs behind the metal desk, her hands resting on top of a pile of bulky manila folders. She wore a black pencil skirt and a dark grey ponte jacket over a long-sleeve blouse. The corporate look. Porter guessed she was in her late 30s or early 40s, but the lines on her face made her look 10 years older. She had streaks of grey in her mid-length hair, and bloodshot eyes and heavy lines etched across her brow. Hawkridge straightened up and glanced impatiently at his watch. "You chaps took your time getting here." "Traffic," said Bald with a shrug. "Anyway, we were busy cleaning up your mess." Hawkridge cocked his chin at Porter. "Well, was it a clean job?" Porter glanced over at Bald. The jock shot him a funny look. He turned back to Hawkridge and nodded stiffly. "It went down just the way we discussed. As far as the cops are concerned, it was a justifiable shooting. We had to give a statement to the PCA, but there might be some follow-up involved." Hawkridge smiled and gave a dismissive wave of his hand, like he was swatting away a bad smell. "No need to worry about the investigation, old fruit. We've got that covered. Consider yourselves in the clear."
"Great," Bald deadpanned. "When do we crack open the bubbly?"
"I'm afraid you'll have to put your celebrations on ice for the time being. We've got another job for you."
"What's the crack?" Porter asked. Hawkridge gestured to the two empty chairs facing the desk.
"Why don't you both take a seat, gentlemen?"
Porter and Bald planted their asses on the chairs and waited for Hawkridge to continue. Porter found himself scanning the room, looking to see if there was any booze lying around the place. He wondered how much longer he could go without a drink before the shakes kicked in again. These days he could hardly last more than a few hours without a drop of the strong stuff. Hawkridge tipped his head at the woman.
"Before we continue, I'd like to introduce you to Angela March. She'll be sitting in with us. Angela is with the Foreign Office, and she'll be helping to coordinate the operation."
"Gentlemen, a pleasure,"
March said. She had a husky, smoker's voice and a cool, professional manner. Porter nodded a greeting at her, but in the back of his head he asked himself, why the hell would some civil servant from the Foreign Office take an interest in an MI5 op? March tapped the manila folders.
"I've read both your files. Excellent work taking down Radoslav Brozovich's gang, by the way. You two are practically minor celebrities inside Whitehall, you know. It's a shame you'll never be able to take public credit for what you did."
"We didn't do it for the glory," Bald said. "We did it because Brozovich killed our mates."
"So I gather," March went on. "Actually, it's one of the reasons we've taken an interest in you. I understand you're both experienced operators, capable of surviving alone in hostile environments for extended periods of time. Your fighting skills are second to none, and you're both extremely loyal towards your fellow SAS men. That's important on this particular operation."
Porter frowned.
How do you mean?
Hawkridge sat down and brushed back his thinning hair.
"I trust you're both familiar with a chap called Ronald Soames?"
The name got their attention. Porter sat bolt upright and tensed.
"Soames," he said, almost spitting out the name. "Aye, we've heard of him."
March took a folder from near the bottom of the pile. She opened it up and glanced down at the first page, then lifted her eyes to Porter.
"I understand Ronald was commanding officer of 22 SAS during your time in the unit."
"For a short while. He transferred a few months after I passed selection, as I remember it."
March read from the page in front of her.
"Ronald Soames, born in Esher, Surrey, in 1947. Born into a prestigious military family. Father Onslow served in the Corps of Guides in the Indian Army, later elected as Conservative MP for Henley-on-Thames. Ronald received his commission from Sandhurst in 1969 and joined the Household Cavalry Division, promoted to the rank of captain and passed SAS selection in 1977, later promoted to the rank of Lieutenant Colonel, commanding officer of 22 SAS from 1987 to 89, became Director of Special Forces in 1994 before retiring in 1997. After he retired from the MOD, Ronald set up his own private military contractor, Janus International. They operate security contracts mostly in Africa."
She stopped reading, unclipped a photograph from the front of the file, and slid it across the desk. Porter and Bald leaned over for a closer look. It was a snap of Ronald Soames, a recent one by the look of it, post-Whitehall. He looked good for his age. He was dressed in an expensive-looking linen suit, light blue shirt underneath, with a collar button popped. Everything about him oozed money. The suit, the watch, the neatly stubbled jaw. In the photograph, Soames was gazing off somewhere to the left of the camera. His eyes were cold and black, like wet stones. His thin lips curled up at the edges to form an arrogant smile. Soames somehow looked both charming and cold-blooded, the kind of guy who acted as if he owned the world and everything in it, and ruthlessly dealt with anyone who thought otherwise. Porter looked up at March and shrugged.
"Looks like Soames has done well for himself."
March said nothing. She closed the folder and dug out a pack of Camels from her Marc Jacobs handbag. Then she plucked out a tab, lit it, and took a long drag.
"Ronald isn't just another retired general. He's one of the most decorated soldiers in the British Army."
She read from his CV again.
"He was awarded the Military Cross for his actions during an IRA ambush outside Belfast. In addition, he's a recipient of the Distinguished Service Order, and received the honour of Knight Commander of the Order of the British Empire."
"That doesn't mean a thing," Porter laughed. "They're bullshit medals."
March gave him a stern look.
"I think that's just jealousy speaking, don't you?"
Porter felt a spark of anger flare up inside his chest. He shook his head and said,
"Do me a favour. It's the worst-kept secret in Hereford that Soames didn't earn that MC. That cunt was sitting behind a desk at barracks while the other lads were out on the top. He wrote up his own citation afterwards."
"Whatever you may think, the plain truth is that Ronald is a highly valuable asset,"
March replied curtly.
"How do you mean?" asked Bald.
March paused while she took another drag on her cigarette.
"Ronald does us favours from time to time."
Bald grinned.
"So do the girls at Spearmint Rhino, love."
March glared at him before she replied.
"Ronald has a particular set of skills. He's good at working in the grey areas, the shadows. He also happens to be very well connected. He knows everyone worth knowing. More importantly, he knows everything about them."
She tapped ash in the ashtray and smiled thinly.
"Let's just say he knows how to get things done."
"That's one way of putting it," said Porter. "Here's another. The bloke's dodgier than a late-night kebab. He stitched up plenty of lads in the regiment. He's a professional backstabber."
"Perhaps,"
March conceded.
"But Ronald is useful in those places where it's politically inappropriate for us to be involved. Places where we need influence, but we can't be seen to be using it. The world is changing. Transparency is everything now. The days of direct intervention are over. Men like Soames buy us power without putting boots on the ground."
"Must pay well and all," said Bald. "I never served under Soames in the regiment, but I've heard that the guy is rich as fuck."
"If Ronald doesn't do this for the money," Hawkridge countered. "He's a patriot. He has plenty of friends inside Whitehall. People who are grateful for the work he's done on our behalf, and right now, he's in trouble."
"What kind of trouble?"
Hawkridge drummed his fingers on the table, shifting his small dark eyes from Bald to Porter.
"Tell me," he said, "how much do either of you chaps know about the situation in Sierra Leone?"
"It's a shithole full of shogies and AIDS,"
Bald quipped. Hawkridge coughed politely.
"That's a rather succinct way of putting it, I suppose, although the reality is somewhat more complicated. As you're probably aware, Sierra Leone is in the grip of a decade-long civil war. 9 years ago, the armed forces of the Revolutionary United Front, backed by soldiers from Liberia, attempted to overthrow the Sierra Leone government under President Joseph Momo. The RUF, led by Fode Sanko, quickly took control of large swathes of the country and forced Momo into exile in a military coup. Ever since, the RUF and the civilian government have been at war. We're talking an endless cycle of coups, revolts, and mass killings."
"Like every other African hellhole, then," said Bald.
"Not quite. You see, Sierra Leone has huge diamond deposits, vastly more than any other country in the region, and located close to the surface, which means one doesn't need expensive machinery to mine the land for diamonds, which means the RUF has had a ready-made source of funds for its military operations."
"Blood diamonds," said Porter.
Hawkridge nodded.
"Exactly. In the past, the RUF has relied heavily on the blood diamond trade to pay for their rebellion. Their soldiers smuggle the deposits south of the border to Liberia, where they are processed and cleaned by Lebanese fences, then sold on to Western markets. We're talking about a trade worth hundreds of millions of dollars per year, money which goes directly into the RUF's war chest."
March said,
4 years ago, HMG decided to intervene. A resolution was passed and UN peacekeepers were put on the ground. The country voted for its first democratically elected president, David Ibrahim Fofana."
March took a last drag on her camel, blew out smoke and stubbed the butt out in the ashtray. Then she brushed her hair back and went on.
"The electoral process wasn't smooth, and it wasn't exactly clean. But it was clean enough for HMG and our cousins in Washington to throw our support behind the new man. However, Fofana's position is weak. Large parts of the country remain under rebel control. Outside Freetown, the country is a war zone. If Fofana was going to stay in power, we had to secure the diamond mines and stop the rebels from seizing the deposits, which is where Ronald came in.
How so? Bald asked.
Janus International was awarded a contract to protect the mining fields in Kono, in the rural east of the country,
March said.
Kono is the biggest diamond mining region in Sierra Leone, which makes it potentially the biggest in West Africa, which makes it potentially one of the biggest in the world.
The Kono mining fields are critical to President Fofana's hopes of staying in power and defeating the RUF,
Hawkridge cut in.
If the rebels managed to seize Kono, they'd be able to bankroll their operations for years to come. Any hopes of ending the conflict would be dead in the water.
He turned to March. She said,
Soames was operating in Sierra Leone with our implicit consent. You might say we have a vested interest in Soames running security on the diamond mine.
Or rather, we did, Hawkridge said, until 24 hours ago.
Porter said, What happened 24 hours ago? Hawkridge paused and glanced at March.
The situation changed, he said.
How? Bald asked.
The rebels launched a new offensive. No one was expecting it. They took everybody by surprise, swept through the government checkpoints, and reached as far as Port Loko, less than 50 miles from Freetown. President Fofana and his advisers fled across the border to Conakry, Guinea.
March cleared her throat.
Without Fofana, the civilian government has effectively collapsed. The rebels have taken great encouragement from the president's departure. We believe that they are preparing for a full-blown assault on the capital. There's widespread panic on the streets. Everyone remembers what happened the last time the RUF rolled into town. Their soldiers engaged in an orgy of violence, looting, rape, murder. Thousands were killed, many more displaced.
Porter scratched his jaw. Where's Soames in all this?
Somewhere inside Freetown, Hawkridge said, overseeing the Kono contract. It's imperative that we get him out of the city immediately, before the security situation deteriorates any further.
Bald gave a casual shrug of his shoulders.
So, stick the guy on a plane. You don't need to send us halfway across the world just so we can hold his fucking hand.
It's not as simple as that.
Bald stared at the guy.
There's a fucking surprise. When is it ever with you lot?
Hawkridge stiffened his jaw and said,
Yesterday morning, GCHQ picked up chatter in Moscow. They're intelligence people at the FSB. It appears they're dispatching a team to Sierra Leone.
Porter did a double take.
The Russians? What's their involvement in all this?
We're not entirely sure, but we think it might be to do with the diamond mines.
Here's what we know, March said. The Russians have cut a deal with the military leader of the RUF rebels, a charming man who calls himself General Mosquito. The deal is weapons in exchange for concessions on the diamond mines, in the event the rebels take over the country.
Porter nodded.
That's why the rebels have suddenly got their shit together. They've got brand new kit from the Russians.
Exactly, said Hawkridge. We think the Russians have sent in a team to expedite matters, take advantage of the chaos on the ground and knock Soames on the head. Once he's out of the way, they can seize control of the Kono mines. That would simultaneously cut short any attempt by Fofana to regain power and hand the keys to the country to the RUF.
And Russia's new president gets an early win,
March added.
So Soames is a target,
Porter said. March gave a cautious nod.
At this moment, Downing Street is discussing options for a military response to drive back the rebels and help Fofana regain the initiative. But our first priority has to be to get Ronald out of the country. He's under threat and he needs our help.
Porter listened in silence. His head throbbed with pain, as if someone was stabbing the backs of his eyeballs with an ice pick.
What's the plan? Bald asked.
Ronald has gotten us out of some tight spots in the past, March said. Now we're going to return the favour. We need you to fly to Freetown and find Soames, then get him the hell out of the country, before the Russians get to him first.